Hey there! Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking, I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, my name is Tracy Morgan, your host at New Books in Psychoanalysis, part of the New Books Network. And today we have back with us Dr. Neil Altman to speak about his most recent publication, White Privilege, Psychoanalytic Perspectives, published by Rutledge Focus. And Neil, what is the, is it 21 or 20? When was this book published?
It actually was available starting in September of 20. But for some reason that I can't explain to you, they put the date as 21. But it actually came out in 20.
So it's an even newer book then. Okay, that's fine.
Right.
It's an older, a very new book that's a little older. Okay, so for the listening audience, just a little background about Neil Altman. He's on the faculty at the William Allenson White Institute in New York City, an honorary member of the William Allenson White Society and visiting faculty at Amdekar University, is that correct, of New Delhi, India?
That's close enough.
Close enough? Okay. he's editor emeritus and associate editor of Psychoanalytic Dialogues and on the editorial board or staff, of the Journal of Infant, Child, and Adolescent Psychotherapy, International Journal of Applied Psychoanalytic Studies, the Journal of Child and the Journal of Child Psychotherapy. Most recently, he is the author of the book we're interviewing him on today, White Privilege. But he also we had an interview here many years ago now on Neil's book, The Analyst in the Inner City: Race, Class, and Culture Through a Psychoanalytic Lens. 2010. Wow. Okay.
Right.
That was a while ago.
So
you were one of my early interviews. I hope I didn't do a terrible job.
No, you did a wonderful job. And I really enjoyed, I still remember how wonderful that interview was.
Okay, I'm glad. I was just a babe in the woods. We'll see how I do today. But he's also the author of a couple of other publications, Psychoanalysis in Times of Accelerating Cultural Change, Spiritual Globalization, that's 2015, and finally, co-author of Relational Child Psychotherapy. So without further ado, welcome back to the
podcast.
Thank
you, Tracy.
Yeah, really glad to have you here. This is actually, just to give you a little context, Neil, I sometimes do things in threes. I don't know what that's all about. But anyway, I did it recently. I've sort of been doing interviews with people who've written books about race. And the first you're the last in this sort of little tripartite series of sorts. I spoke to Sheldon George in his book, Trauma and Race, and M. Fakhri Davids, his book, Internal Racism, and then your book, White Privilege, caught my eye, and
I'm so glad it did.
Yeah. It certainly did. So, can you tell us what motivated you to write this book? If you can know your motivations.
It's a little bit hard to remember. It was before race was on everybody's lips. I've been writing about race ever since 1993, at least, when I wrote The Analyst in the Inner City, and before then too, but that's getting into such ancient history that I can't tell you the details of that. I worked at Bronx Lebanon Hospital, so, you know, obviously racial differences were part of my daily clinical life there. And I have a long history of being woke and asleep with respect to race, going back to my childhood. But when I started to write this, it was before George Floyd was killed. And I was aware of people who were trying to do educational workshops about race for white people. And it struck me from the very first time that I was aware of that, that there was a, how can I put it, a more, nowadays we might call it more woke than now attitude on people who were doing that sort of thing. And it always grated against me. And I couldn't quite articulate what was going on and what bothered me about it. So I started to think about that, and things very quickly fell into place. And I realized that anybody who presents themselves as being knowledgeable about race or culture or social class, for that matter, or gender or sexual orientation, anybody who presents themselves as being on top of those issues is going to do something counterproductive when it comes to educating people, because inherently it's going to shame the listeners or the students about it. The second thing that fed that feeling was I wrote an article that was in my 2010 book called Black and White Thinking. And in that chapter, I talked about my own cluelessness about race in the case of some clinical work that I did with a man called Mr. A, that I called Mr. A. And there was no other way I could have written about race except to portray myself as clueless, because I knew that I was clueless and that I was learning as I went and that I was making a lot of mistakes. And that in fact is, from my point of view, that was part and parcel of being white. And so so that was already my orientation. And so I decided to try to articulate what I thought was the flaw in approaches to educating people. I'll just throw in here one other thought, which is that the whole idea of being culturally competent also grated against me, because I thought the only way, first of all, who is culturally competent? And the only way to be culturally competent is to acknowledge one's cultural incompetence. So the way that works clinically is that you have to be open, truly open to hearing about when you mess up. And if you think that you know, then you're not going to be open to hearing when you mess up. Not that any of us are so open, but that's the way I thought. So I took it from there. That's the thing that motivated me.
I was thinking this book is a kind of psychoanalytic companion to Robin DiAngelo's White Fragility, that you kind of do something which I appreciate. It's like I was writing, you know, about, like, I was like, yeah, he's kind of saying, like, trying to toughen white people up a little bit, kind of like a coach saying, come on, team, everyone is destructive. And when you hurt someone, if you don't, you know, actually atone, like, aren't you worse for the wear? Or, you know, come on, you know, be an object that survives destruction. It's like, you know, you're not all bad. So would I be like kind of off? I mean, did you I forget when that book came out, but I thought this was like a deeper, a psychoanalytic understanding of something that D'Angelo is going after.
I mean, I agree with that. I think that that she takes a more knowing position about it in general than I'm comfortable taking. And, you know, I think there's something very constructive about what she and others who write in a similar vein do, like Ibram X. Kendi, he's Black, you know, so he speaks from a different point of view about what's entailed in being an anti-racist, because he knows his experience as a Black man, which I don't know, and Robin DiAngelo doesn't know. But I think there's still something constructive about white people thinking about and writing about the vulnerability that comes with being white and how that can harden into defensiveness.
Right, and harden into using dehumanization as a way to shore oneself up, which does tend to backfire. Like if you think about people who have killed people, like in war, like they're usually not better off for it. You know what I mean? It's like that act of destruction that can't be undone. It usually doesn't fortify one's ability to tolerate, you know, the slings and arrows of reality.
That's the thing that's just killing me now about what's going on in Israel and Palestine. You know, I mean, it's happening everywhere around the world a lot of the time. So, you know, in a sense, it doesn't make sense to single out that conflict above all the others that are always going on. But I'm aware myself of how I, in various ways, dissociate and don't really take in what's going there and really have no way to imagine how I could take it in and still get up in the morning. So I think that applies not only to war, but to all forms of dehumanization in the form of cruelty and just unthinkable ways of treating other people.
For sure. And I think what you're saying, I think part of what you're saying in the book is, but you don't come out and say this, but I was like, he's saying the superego is not going to save us, in terms of like, you know, the trainings, the knowledge, the knowingness, the punishment, the shaming, it does have a boomerang effect. You know, when it comes to
I like the way you put that, that the superego is not going to save us.
It isn't. Yeah, I just finished teaching this past semester a course at Center for Modern Psychoanalytic Studies on the racism and the development of the psyche, and the pressure. You know, like when you're trying to meet the demands of the superego, you can't be creative. Like it really, you can't have creative thoughts, and you can't think freely, and you can't really think. And it was constantly like trying to work to help the students to, you know, say terrible things. What racism is a form of hatred. And we understand we have hateful feelings. We don't hate our hateful feelings. So what if we, you know, sort of looked at racism as an expression of, you know, on the one hand, insecurity. On the other hand, you know, depending if you're coming from a relational or like a drive approach, but like, you know, insecurity or, you know, or a pleasure in hating. But I, you know, it's a human problem.
Yeah, and I like the way you highlight both sides of it. That there's insecurity, yes, which is what Robin DiAngelo and me sometimes highlight, but that doesn't rule out that it's also a form of hatred and just pure destructiveness, you know, which we've got to acknowledge. And how those two things, like I've never quite thought of it that way, the way you just put it, that those two things draw on each other. Insecurity and destructiveness draw on each other. And they set up a loop between the two of them.
I think you say this. I think this comes across in the book. I mean, it's not, you know, like, I think that it's implicit in what you're writing about. I mean, you use Klein in a way that, you know, basically Klein says, you know, this is it. We don't get, you know, there's no like get out of hate free card, you know, like this is like, but I wanted to ask you, you know, thinking about Klein and thinking about your use of Klein to sort of at some level, like normalize in a sense, like that we do terrible things. And, but you know, the tricky thing I find about using Klein when thinking about racism is that in like love, guilt and reparations, I think that, you know, one of, like in reading that essay, you get to a place where she says, well, why do you make reparations? Because you have an identification.
Is that what she says?
Yes. I reread it this semester and I was like, so how can, you know, when you're using Klein, I mean, certainly, have you read Faulkner David's book, Internal Racism?
I read something by him, but anyway, I'm not sure about that particular. Yeah.
Okay. No, I'm doing a reading group. You can join it. We're starting for June 3rd for four meetings on Faulkner's book. Oh my goodness, now I just forgot what I was going to say. What was I saying? It's menopause.
Klein says.
Yes. Yeah.
Identification, reparation comes from identification.
Yeah, that you see something of yourself, or you see, like, you know, the child wants to destroy the mother, but the mother is also the child's world. And, like, you know, and there's an identification that allows for reparation. And I was thinking about, you know, white identity, right? And identifying as white, which is, as you describe in the book, not white is not black, right? Mm-hmm. That's the place where I get kind of stuck with thinking about
cross-racial identification.
Yeah, and sort of Klein, because I think what you're saying with Klein is you're sort of saying, hey, you know what? This is what we do. It's what we do with our destructiveness.
But what about love? Is love anything other than identification? I think it
right.
has to be.
On a good day, oh, yes.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, it's like, you know, there's the love. We are the same and we love so many of the same things. And then it's like one day you're like, but you're really different than me.
Yeah.
Okay. You know.
But if you're questioning the viability of cross-racial identifications when there's such a wall put up between black and white, then it raises a question, which I'm not prepared to answer. I do think that there's love between black people and white people, as well as very, very nearly, if not totally impenetrable walls set up. And we just don't know. I mean, to bring up this question highlights the mystery of all of this. And that's a good place to be because it keeps us inquiring and thinking.
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious, ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor is the solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
Yes, yes. No, I agree. It also kind of keeps us humble. I mean, in a good way, like humble, like I don't, you know, right. And it's actually, you know, knowing is in some senses, you know, being the one that knows is the antithesis of intimacy. Actually, I love it. At a certain point in the book, you kind of take on the interpretation as shaming. I think it's from Levinson and, you know, other thinkers, which I really appreciate that. But maybe in a sense, you know, like it's with whiteness, I wonder what you think about this. I mean, this is a thought I had from reading your book, was like, you know, who can reveal a white person to a white person powerfully is someone black who knows them. You know what I mean? In terms of our unconscious, you know, racism. And, you know, it's sort of like, I don't want to hear that interpretation, you know, like there's that fear. Yeah, that's right. The innocence, right? That quote he has about, you know, the demand that we remain innocent, or the privilege of innocence.
As long as I've got your ear and the ear of other people listening, I just want to make a pitch for James Baldwin. Like, he's, when you asked at the beginning, what are the roots of my writing this? It's in James Baldwin. I just feel it just took scales off my eyes when I read him, and I can't get enough of him. And he knows something about white people, maybe not everything about white people, but I learned so much about myself from reading Baldwin.
Mm-hmm. Anything in particular that you really that was sort of that particularly resonated or shed the scales?
Yeah, I mean, Baldwin has a way of being very direct and confrontational and loving at the same time. And he says he writes his books about white people out of love, and it's so true. I mean, I just can't. It's what you said before, that he, as a black man, knows white people in a way that white people, up to that point, had just not been prepared to know themselves.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. His correspondence with Norman Mailer, I don't know if you know it, but anyway, it's like he's so good to that man. And, you know, after he writes, Mailer writes The White Negro, and Baldwin is no coward. He does not mince words, but he's also, he remains on the side of being humane. And you are writing in this book really about, like, you know, what does it take? And this is something I'm thinking a lot about. I think I have a quote from you here. Where is it? If I can find it, where the heck did it go? Just about, really, in short, about like the impulse to dehumanize and how to not dehumanize the one that's been dehumanizing, right? I mean, that's a strong impulse, to strip away the humanity of the one who has acted in a inhumane way, I guess, which is such a stupid word. Inhumane, it's like actually that's human. To debase others is a part of what, you know, part of what we do. And it's, you know, yeah, it's not pretty. But, well, let me ask you a question. This is, you know, what would you say if I said that in psychoanalysis over the last 40 years or so, the turn away from the death drive has allowed the field, except for very recently, to turn a blind eye towards racism?
Oh,
it's just an idea I'm having, because we can talk about gender and sexuality all day long using psychoanalysis, but it's somehow like, oh, we can't, until more recently, aside from your work and a couple of other analysts, but most analysts are like, you can't use psychoanalytic thinking to think about racism. That's society. Uh-huh. That's sociology.
I see.
And I don't know. So what if I were to say that the turn away from the death drive hasn't helped us?
Well, I mean, all I can say to that is that it's intriguing to me to think about, let's reimplant the death drive and then see what happens to the way we think about race.
Yeah.
I think that's a really interesting question.
That's what I was trying to say to my students. I was like, oh, we need to hate and to love. So
and destroy, not just hate.
Yes. No, we need, exactly. We need to destroy. And this is a part of what we do and our life's work. And I think you get into this with like talking about, so I am puzzled, okay, by the Isaiah Berlin, you and Mitchell and Greenberg. I was like, what are you guys doing with Isaiah Berlin? It's so interesting to me. Can you talk about, because his thinking is very important in the argument that you're laying out in this book, I think for you. And can you talk to us about Berlin and yeah.
Well, Berlin is the one, I mean, he said something very simple, which is so simple that people dismiss him as not being profound. But what he says is that there's no such thing as having values without conflicting with some of your other values. You know, and once you say that, and he has one example that's so striking to me. He says something like equality, and I don't even remember exactly how, something like equality and democracy are contradictory.
Absolutely, yeah.
Okay, I said it right then. So
yeah, no, that's him. That's his argument. Yeah,
yeah. And yeah. I remember times when, in my own life, I realized that was true. And so, okay, so let's, like I said before, what if we reimplant the death drive, then what? So let's say that there's no such thing as having values without conflicting with others of your values. Where does that leave you, right? And so I think where that leaves us is that we're always juggling and doing the best we can. In an imperfectly, and that circles back to the question of how can you train people to be anti-racist? You have to start out by saying being anti-racist is going to run you up against parts of yourself that you would stand behind if confronted with those things. And so, like, for example, I've thought for a long time that guilt about privilege, and you know, one of the main points of my book is that privilege is a complicated concept. But anyway, so let's say guilt about privilege. Why do we feel guilt? And I think it's not because we're privileged; it's because we wouldn't give up our privilege if we had the chance. And we do have the chance all the time. I can walk out the door today and do a number of things that would amount to renunciation of different forms of privilege that I have, and I will not do that. And that's what creates guilt. I mean real guilt, not guiltiness. Guiltiness, as Mitchell and Adam Phillips described it, is the pretense of guilt. When you don't face the fact that you will not do what would be necessary to not feel guilty. That also goes along with everything else, with the inherent destructiveness of people. You can't do anything without causing some kind of harm. And so I forget where this started, but Isaiah Berlin. So Isaiah Berlin tells us that we're always in conflict with ourselves. Mm-hmm. And so,
right, that our values are often, if you dig deep enough, you discover that you're at cross purposes with yourself, or just like you're, you know, there's the unconscious conflict, and then Berlin kind of fits in like that, you know, at the level of values, it's like you're not as monolithic as you think you are when you really start digging around and, you know, inside yourself. Oh God, right. Or is virtuous, right? It's not always about exactly. It's not driven by true virtue. You know, do you know the work of Noelle McAfee? Oh, I'm going to say it wrong. Jeez, and I interviewed her. McAfee. McAfee. There we go. She has a book called Fear of Breakdown, Politics and Psychoanalysis. Oh, it's great. You'd love it. So she uses Winnicott, and you two sort of are covering some similar terrain. She highlights mourning, whereas I think you highlight, you know, sort of slouching toward the depressive position, if you, you know, when you can get there. And she says something like, you know, when it comes to creating any kind of political change, we have to promote mourning and beware of melancholia, because we have to accept, this is a paraphrase, but that in politics, loss is a part of the whole process. And with white privilege, or with dismantling it, much must be given up. We're talking about loss. And I, you know, there's also that essay by Audrin Harris on the perverse pact. I forget the exact title, but she speaks about these figures she has from the, I'm going to say it incorrectly, that I believe Indigenous people in Canada, the Haida, and she talks in this essay about that these artifacts should be given back, and her feeling of like, I don't want to, the difficulty of renunciation. But you seem to have the idea that there's something to be gained. I think that there's a spirit in the book, that there's something to be gained in this renunciation. Can you talk about this?
Yeah, I mean, I'm thinking about that a lot these days because I'm reading the Bhagavad Gita. I spent a lot of time in India, so I'm always trying to get back to the origins of that way of living. And I think it's in Baldwin, too, because what Baldwin does is he shows us the price we pay for not renouncing, which is the opposite of renunciation is acquisitiveness, which very easily takes over your life. And so, and it also connects with Manny Gent's idea of surrender. And, right? So Baldwin, for my left brain, Baldwin makes sense of why it's beneficial to people to renounce, to surrender. I would say surrender is a much better word.
Yes, you know, yes.
To stop, mm-hmm. to get off the treadmill, etc. Mm-hmm. Why did we start talking about that?
Well, we were just, what did I ask? I was thinking about renunciation, and you have the idea that there's something to be gained in, as you would call it, surrender, which I totally accept that. That seems great, a good way to put it. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So that links Baldwin with something in Hinduism and Buddhism. Mm-hmm. You know, which for me is perfect, because the first half of my life was about India and the second half of my life is about Baldwin. So, you know, it's too perfect. But no, I'm not going to undermine that. I think that's really what my life has been about.
Uh-huh. Well, Baldwin is so, there's a maturity to him. That's really the word that comes to mind. And it's kind of like, you know, you can be the more mature person, there is a nice feeling. You know what I mean? One does get something, even though there's renunciation or facing hard truths about oneself. You know, aren't we tired of like white people, like, tired of running, like being on the run all the time from running scared, exactly, like not wanting to get caught, so don't want to, and hence the guiltiness, you know, and it's just such a tire, it's like a tiresome operation. I'm like, listen, you know, like this is not like, you know, you actually have a part of the book which I really identified with, which is like, you know, what does it mean to like win the game when the game is rigged, you know, I don't think that's exactly how you, but there's something about like attaining power when like you know, it's prearranged that you're gonna win. Don't you always know that, like, you really didn't win?
Well, from that point of view, people probably think I'm better than other people at figuring out how it's rigged. You know, like, you might come out five feet ahead of other people, but I'll come out 10 feet ahead because I have an additional insight. But let me bring in one other thing, which is Toni Morrison. Toni Morrison, that's the third dimension of my life. This is the beauty. She writes about a mother who kills her own child to protect her child from slavery. I mean, is there anything more horrific than what she writes about? And she writes about it in a beautiful way. And it raises the question for me of how do we retrieve the beauty of life in the face of so much ugliness? You know, that's what I was referring to about how do you really take in what's happening in the Gaza Strip and walk out the door and look at the blue sky? And how do you put all that together? And, well, you can't. But if you could, it would look like Toni Morrison's writings. And I don't know what to say about beyond that, but the posthumous book that just came out, I don't remember the name of it.
No, I don't even know. I'm not even aware. I don't think I'm aware of it.
Well, I'll read those books that you just mentioned, and if you promise to read this one, we'll all benefit. But there's a posthumous thick book that just came out, which is all about this, like, how does beauty inform honesty and vice versa? Mm-hmm. So anyway, I just wanted to make sure I got that.
Yeah, no, that's interesting. I mean, Sheldon George has a chapter on Beloved, and such a gorgeous, beautiful reading of that text and of Setha, a descent into a delusional world and what it takes for her to come out of it as well, right? I mean, the second half of the novel is, you know, her daughter who wants to be in touch with reality and her mother who sees her dead child everywhere and what it takes for her to sort of to move out of delusion. Anyway, it's just, yeah, it's a beautiful reading. Now, I wanted to bring our attention to something else that I think is interesting in this book, which is your attempt to trouble certain words. And I was reading some Hannah Arendt, and I was like, just happened to have been reading it, and I was like, oh, this is what Neil Altman is doing. So I want to read you this quote, and I have a question. It's from The Human Condition. Power is actualized only where word and deed have not parted company, where words are not empty and deeds not brutal, where words are not used to violate and destroy, but to establish relations and create new realities. You offer us several, you take on several words: whiteness, privilege, power, guilt, and an attempt to investigate them. Why these words, obviously whiteness and privilege, but also power, guilt, and guilt. Can you talk to us about what you were trying to trouble with the investigation of these words?
Yeah. Well, I started with privilege and being aware that people use the word privilege as if it's just understood that it means money and power, political power. But once I started thinking about that, I started thinking about other words. Like, we just use words without thinking what we're saying, like power, like we invade Grenada and conquer this little island, and we say that was an attempt to demonstrate U.S. power. No, it's the opposite. It demonstrates U.S. helplessness after losing the war in Vietnam. And so then the bully, of course, you know, the schoolyard bully who is trying to be powerful and gets other people to buy into that, but it actually demonstrates the bully's helplessness. So we use words that actually speak to their opposite as if they didn't. And I couldn't stop seeing that in all these words that are in the constellation around race, et cetera.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Like white privilege, we could rename it, right? Like what would be a better white anxiety, white helplessness? I mean,
Those are all different aspects of it. You know, it's not like you cover the whole territory with anyway. Like now, I won't say privilege without saying economic and political privilege, if that's the kind of privilege that I'm talking about. Mm-hmm. But it leads to a mouthful all the time.
Sometimes
I mean another kind of privilege, then I have to say that.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Right. And I think there's also a sense in the book that like the privilege to be outside, I don't know if this is me just reading into it, but like sort of the quote unquote privilege to sort of be on one's own island, to be alone, the privilege to be outside of the community. Like there's a sense of the privilege to disconnect. And I think you ask, is that like where does that lead you? You know, like being so disconnected, what's the difficulty? What stands in your way of being able to tolerate being connected? You know, there's as we know, like if you know patients who isolate themselves and you know don't want to be with other people, we know that they're not very strong psychically. You know, their ability to tolerate difference or you know, it's so the privilege to be apart and above.
But then that takes us back to Isaiah Berlin, right? That everything that's a privilege is also a liability and vice versa.
Mm-hmm.
Seen
mm-hmm.
from a different point of view.
Yeah, absolutely. So for you, like you talk about liberal philosophy versus liberal politics. And I thought that was a helpful, heartening distinction, even though I was like, yeah, where is liberal philosophy when you need it? But it seems to me to be sort of it works really well with, you know, this sort of Kleinian idea of the depressive position. I kept thinking that, you know, that there's such a strong, I had never really put that together, that like, what does it take to like really like sort of embrace a liberal philosophy, which is to say like I'm more mixed up than I thought. You know what I mean? I do contain multitudes, and it's a little messy.
I was afraid when I was writing that part about liberalism that it was like slipping out of my fingers as I was writing, like it's so out of fashion in the political world anyway, but just generally in the world, like people are so angry and taking, and you know, that's needed too, because one of the things Klein says is that we need the paranoid schizoid position. Otherwise we'd be waffling all the time and there's no good in that. So, but at the same time, thinking about what's au courant right now, it's not liberalism. But in any of its meanings. And so I felt like I've got to grab it like before it disappears. And I don't want to give it a push either by saying ridiculous things, but it kept seeming right as I wrote about it.
That's interesting, right? Because of neoliberalism, like it's just got like this really, really bad rap. But you know, you're like at the Frankfurt School writing in German, you know, you're like, we're going to still, after all that's happened, we're going to still write in German. And you're like, after all that's gone on under the name of liberalism and neoliberalism, you're like, let's go back to what this philosophy is. You know what I mean? Like, you're not willing. You're like this, it does have some value. It's very much of a piece also with like the work of somebody, maybe like Philip Bromberg, like this idea of like multiplicity. You talk a lot about multiplicity. You know, the idea of like, it's not, you know, you're in different self states, for instance, you know, and Berlin seems to kind of just know that.
Right, right. That's right. Bromberg says you don't make decisions, you make choices.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
That incorporates Isaiah Berlin.
Well, there's a long Berlin relational tradition longer than I do. I didn't even put that one together. I mean, it just reminded me of him. You ask a question, and I don't think that there's a simple answer. But I feel like, you know, grappling with how do you put it? The question remains. You ask, how can one avoid dismissiveness toward people who strongly differ with respect to issues on which one has strong feelings? And I was like, do you have any hot tips? Do you have any, you know, like, I mean, I'm kind of kidding, but I'm like, do you have more to say? Yeah, because it's so tempting when you're mad and you don't like what somebody's saying.
It's right. I mean, one thing there, I think the answer is in your question, that you let yourself be mad when you're mad, and then take a step back and say something else. But I remember when I was teaching a class once, and I was saying, from the point of view of so-and-so, and it was clear that I disagreed with so-and-so, I said, from the point of view of so-and-so, and one of the students said, you don't have to represent favorably every point of view. And I felt outed by that. Like, oh, you're right. Why am I showing this point of view in a favorable light?
Mm-hmm. That's interesting.
Yeah.
Right. Yeah.
And with patience, sometimes I'm uneasy because somebody is saying something that in the moment I consider deplorable, and I'm looking at them with an understanding look on my face, but I don't know what else to do.
Read Fakhri David's book.
Oh, really? Okay.
It's important because he talks about this. He will say it's not a new idea, and it comes out of, you know, the work of Rosenfeld and Steiner. But like, kind of the idea of there's an internal racist organization in the mind, and that it's a part of the normal mind. He will say, and anyway, I don't know. I think he has got some really interesting clinical cases in there that give you really generative to grapple with. I'm really hoping that the Center for Modern Psychoanalytic Studies will have him as their keynote at their next conference in the next year. And so you'll have to come down from Boston because he's really a neat guy.
Will you leave me 30 seconds before we finish? Because I want to say something about talking with you.
Oh, okay, sure. I mean, I just had one final question, which was, so you take us to field theory. Like we kind of go, you know, we move from sort of relational, Kleinian, and then we're in field theory. And you have something to say about field theory and kind of psychoanalysis in the larger field. And I wanted to see if you could say some more, about your thinking there. Like, what is it about field theory? Yeah.
Well, I guess I'm just really impressed with how whatever you're talking about shifts according to how you define the field within which you're talking or doing something. And I guess I learned that from being in psychoanalytic training and learning about family therapy at the same time. And it's like, what? Like, this mother who as an individual looks whatever, borderline or, you know, having a lot of Kleinian destructiveness or something. And then you put her in her field and you see that, of course, I mean, she's dealing with this husband or her mother or, you know, a child who's very provocative, or like, you got to look at both of those things. Otherwise, you know what I mean?
Yeah. Well, otherwise, I mean, I think it's again, back to your point about dehumanization and about, like, you know, once you sort of put things like in the group, you know, you look at like sort of the aerial view and say like, oh, this all makes more sense. Like one would go in this direction. One would have these feelings. You know, people sort of come back in full So I think field theory is super, for me, it's super complicated to understand. I mean, Civitarese, Ferro, like their work is a lot for me to take in. Don Stern is a little easier. His thinking about it, it's a little easier for me, but
you find it confusing because there's so many levels of field.
Yes, it's like,
is that right?
I mean, it's so Italian. I mean, it's so, you know, Civitarese and Ferro are so Italian, and they are so great and so, you know, so kind of brilliant. But it's like, it's very it's like a mille foglie, a million leaves, like a, you know, one of those sweets that have like all the different little crepes, or a mille foglie in Italian is the word. So, you know, it's
you
a lot of.
You always got to think about what country am I in at the moment.
Right.
Okay,
you've
let's
got
turn the dial and let's recap. Oh, I'm in Italy right now. I see.
Shift
okay.
the frequency. This
right,
is right,
right.
This is how it works, and it's like
yeah.
a very long dinner, and there's a lot of multiple voices at the table, and there's some argument, and then everyone laughs. that's field theory kind of can bring you that like a cacophony. Yeah, I mean, it is. It's a cacophony. So we're almost out of time. I mean, before you say something about me, if there's something more you wanted to tell the listeners about, any, you know, about the book, about forthcoming plans, like what are you working on another book? You know, what's going on?
I don't know if I'm going to work on another book.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe not. I'm not sure. I keep entertaining possibilities and failing to write them down and forgetting what they were. So I think that suggests I might write another book at some point. But
yes,
if there's anything more I want to say, it's that, are we going to stop exactly like now? No.
I'm going over time. I have a patient waiting outside, but we're still talking. No, I don't. I do not have, I don't have anybody till 5:15. I have a supervisor.
Okay, so I'm going to say that, one thing I'd like to leave the listeners with is if your patient who's of a different race or ethnicity asks you, was that a prejudice thing you just said? Or I think that was a prejudice thing you just said. You should consider that maybe the patient's right and that it doesn't brand you, that it was true in the moment. It's true about one part of yourself, but that's one of the advantages of multiplicity, is that you can say yes, and you don't have to be defensive and say that's true about one part of me. You can just say, yes, let me see it from your point of view, without feeling like you've become a bad person by virtue of doing that. The fact that you're open to hearing it, in fact, is another part of you. And I think that would make this work a lot easier if we kept that in mind. So that's the one thing I would like to leave the listeners with. And about talking with you, I would say that what I find in talking with you is that you say, I noticed that you say in the book something, then you'll say what it is. And you feed back my thought as you read about it, as you read it in the book, in your own words, which seems in a way familiar and unfamiliar at the same time, like you're feeding it back to me through the lens of you, and it's different, right? And that is fantastic. That is another example of liberalism. That is that every person is a different country, you know, in a certain way. Like, oh, why did she use that word? And what can I learn from that? So that's something I really like about talking with you.
I'm delighted, because it's true. I have to hold both what it is that I've read and try to represent the author. But, you know, I do like to have a conversation and say, this is what I'm taking from it. And I always think when people read something that you've written, it is like a, you know, it's kind of an interesting buffet, like to hear like what they chose from and what stayed with them. And that's why I always ask, is there something I didn't talk about, you know, that like I didn't focus on? Because, you know, authors really, sometimes I'm capable of missing the main point, you know, like, I mean, because of where my interests go, and that, you know, I don't want to do that, you know, like that's, so I hope I haven't missed like the main point, right? I think I've gotten close enough. You know, yeah. All right. Well, thank you so much for spending time with us and talking. And this is Tracy Morgan, your host at New Books in Psychoanalysis, part of the New Books Network. And I'm signing off for now. Okay.
Okay, bye-bye.
Bye.